This is Audible.
HiBridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents Shortest Way Home, One Mayor's Challenge and a Model for America's Future, by Pete Buttigieg. Read by Pete Buttigieg. Everyone's own homeland is Kashmir to him. Afghan proverb. Section 1. Remembering. Factories were our cathedrals, pushed up out of the Great Plains. Michael Collins. Chapter 1. The South Bend I Grew Up In. Dawn comes late, here along the western limit of the eastern time zone, so far from the coast that our first sunrise of the year arrives after 8 in the morning. Most January days are cloudy, making sunup a hidden and gradual process, less a moment of daybreak than a cold shift away from the illuminated night, in which the cloud ceiling and the snow cover reflect the sodium streetlights between them into an orange glow, so bright you can read the paper outside at 4 in the morning. So the first hint of morning actually makes things seem darker, as the amber nightlight yields and the sky deepens into a kind of electric indigo. The species of light evolve around you, from luminous ambience to discrete points of light along the horizon, the general giving way to the specific. Looking at this scene from the 14th floor windows of the mayor's corner office, it's easy to imagine that you're in the wheelhouse of a ship at sea. Adding to the effect, if it's windy out, the air pushes and pulls the picture window panes, making a noise far out of proportion to the wind's actual strength, as though the entire building is buffeted by a great gale. A few snowflakes whirl out of the air and fly up across the reflection of your fluorescent-lit face, and you feel like touching a piece of furniture to make sure you are steady. It was that kind of deep winter morning on New Year's Day 2012, my first day as mayor of South Bend, a city of 100,000 people in northern Indiana. My hometown. Peering out across the empty desk into the lingering blue of a slow-motion midwinter dawn, the sky no longer orange but not yet gray, I pondered what to do with my first few minutes of unscheduled time. Day one had commenced early, with a visit to the street department garage to encourage the plow crews, and a stop at Memorial Hospital to greet Caleb, the first newborn of the new year. Now I was upstairs in my new office, and there was plenty on the schedule for the rest of the day, building up to the formal swearing-in ceremony set for that evening. But in this unstructured moment, what exactly should I do? Go over the speech one more time? Open my new city government email? Check the weather again, I quickly decided, and find out how the plows are doing. Snow, of course, can be a beautiful thing. It is the great benefactor of children, promising canceled school and hot chocolate and downhill sledding. But it is the mortal enemy of any mayor it touches. One day's worth of bungled plowing is all that stands between a mayor and political disaster. At a minimum, as Mike Bloomberg experienced, a rough or mishandled snowstorm can bring days of criticism. At worst, as Chicago's Michael Blandick and New York's John V. Lindsay learned the hard way, it spells career oblivion. Even after it melts, mayors curse the past winter's snowfall, because it invariably refreezes to become the progenitor of a mayor's other great enemy and prey, the pothole. As I learned growing up, snow can be a great unifier in a place like South Bend. When a storm is past and the glinting winter sun emerges, so do we, with our shovels, and as water drips from icicles along garage gutters, we appear in our alleys to dig out our cars. It becomes a social activity based on cheerful, neighborly commiseration. Snow furnishes the grounds for conversation, and even though we pride ourselves on being able to handle it, a good enough snowstorm can supply conversational fodder for weeks or even years to come. Like rain for the English, snow to a South Bender is worthy of intensive discussion, even though, or perhaps because, it is so familiar. Ask anyone who is old enough to remember, and they will tell you all about the blizzard of 78. According to my parents, it was still the universal conversation starter even 2.5 years later, when they arrived on College Street with their U-Haul from Texas not long before I was born. "Have you heard about the blizzard of 78?" someone would ask, as you were pumping gas, waiting in the checkout line at Martin's supermarket, or slicing into your roasted chicken at a dinner party. And once the question is asked, it makes no difference how you answer. Prepare to hear about the blizzard of 78. By late January that cold year, there were already a couple feet of snow on the ground. Forecasters knew a storm was coming on that Thursday, January 26th, perhaps a serious one, but no one realized it would be historic. The mayor was traveling, so Pete Mullen, the city controller, was in charge by default. By the time he arrived at work, as the snowfall gathered speed, it had already been a terrifying day for Pete. He had started his usual morning routine, shower, shave, putting on a suit, and was getting some coffee when he paused to check on his 2-week-old infant and realized the child had stopped breathing. The baby was scarlet red. No air was coming out of his mouth. Pete turned him over and patted him on the back. Still nothing. Sprinting upstairs with the infant in hand, he woke his alarmed wife and handed the child to her while grabbing the phone to call 911. Soon, there were police cars, a fire truck, and an ambulance at the house. As Pete recalled, when they hear it's a baby, they pull out all the stops to get there. It wasn't snowing yet, at least not much. A paramedic stuck something in the baby's throat and opened his passageway, and soon he was healthily inhaling and exhaling. Pete rode in the ambulance to the emergency room at St. Joseph Hospital, where the family's pediatrician was waiting, while Mary Lou waited anxiously at the house with their other kids. Once it was confirmed that the boy was all right, the doctor offered to give Pete and the baby a ride home, then take Pete to the office. So by the time he arrived on the 14th floor at noon, Pete Mullen was already drained. But it was clear now that this storm was going to be a big deal. I can picture Pete looking out at the same view I see now, noting the shrinking visibility. First, you can't see the west side anymore. Then all you can see are the buildings across the street. Then just the courthouse down below. And finally, nothing at all but a dull white glow where your view of the city ought to be. By mid-afternoon, Pete was telling everyone to get home, but be ready to come in the next day. Not willing to risk leaving the office and being himself unable to get back, he found a couch and spent the night there, waking up 5 hours later with his suit still on. As the winds blew snow into drifts ever higher, stranding cars and burying neighborhoods, Pete would stay in the office for 2 more nights, manning the city's response. On Thursday, temperatures fell to 0, and winds peaked at 55 miles per hour, as the bulk of what would be a 3-foot snowfall struck the city head on. But it was the drifts that set records, piling up 10 feet or even more. The Chevy dealership downtown loaned the police department some of its 4-wheel-drive vehicles for emergency personnel to get around. If you were lucky, or unlucky, enough to be working downtown on the emergency response, you might rate a lift home. Once or twice a day, they would get Pete home to check on his family and get a change of clothes, a process that involved dropping him off at the corner of his block and calling his wife to tell her to expect him as he trudged up the unplowed street in the nearly chest-deep snow. Almost an hour later, he would make it to the door of his house, panting, 5 doors down from where he had been dropped. City resources were not enough, so Pete arranged to contract with every individual he could find who owned a pickup truck with a plow. By Saturday, the snow had abated, but the stress level was mounting as people began to run out of food and supplies at home. Main roads were beginning to clear, but much of the city remained buried. From a National Guard helicopter, Pete saw how many houses were covered up to the windows. On the campus of Notre Dame, students were jumping out of third-story windows with glee and daring each other to try it from higher. People who really needed to be somewhere got creative. An Israeli dignitary who had been stuck in town for far too long was transported by snowmobile to the LaPorte County line, there to be conveyed somehow to Chicago and on to Tel Aviv. When Pete finally made it to Martin's supermarket, which had a skeleton crew selling whatever perishables they had left, he passed 6 horses tied up in the parking lot. Pete wasn't the only one sleeping at work. Charlie Spire, the director of the Marmaine Pharmacy downtown, knew that people would need him, snow or not, and found a way to keep the pharmacy operating as everything around him shut down. He couldn't let people go without heart medication or dialysis supplies. A few days into the emergency, he realized he had run out of what had suddenly become his most popular item, birth control pills. I can't find statistics to prove it, but locals speak of the hospital resorting to placing maternity beds in the hallway to accommodate an autumn baby boom 9 months after the storm. As normalcy reasserted itself in the weeks to follow, a new problem arose: where to actually put all the snow. Around here, it may stay below freezing for weeks, so the snow doesn't just melt. That winter's snowfall came to 136 inches, millions of cubic yards of snow that had to find some place to go. It was forbidden, for environmental reasons, to push it into the river, which moves so quickly that it never fully freezes over, even on sub-zero days. Downtown, a stalled development project, now a bustling hotel and office building, had led to a semi-permanent giant hole taking up a city block, known to locals as the Hole. This turned out to be the simplest place for the whole downtown's worth of snow to be dumped. A radio station hosted a contest to see who could guess when the last of the snow would be gone. The winner guessed a date in May. For my newly arrived parents-to-be, these blizzard stories must have really been something. They had come from El Paso, Texas, where they had lived and commuted to work at New Mexico State University in nearby Las Cruces. This was high desert at the foot of the Oregon Mountains, and snowflakes were rare and short-lived. The daughter of an Army officer who retired at Fort Bliss in El Paso, my mother had attended high school in a sun-washed building less than 2 miles from the border with Juarez in Chihuahua State, Mexico. No river valley could be more different from South Bend's than that of the Rio Grande as it shunts through El Paso in the concrete casing that keeps its banks from shifting, a river forbidden to meander like normal rivers because it is not just a waterway, but also an international border. Mom had lived in Indiana before, as a girl in Scott County, but that was on the other end, near Kentucky. So far south of here, it might as well have been a different state. For my father, who had emigrated from the island nation of Malta, the snow would have been even more exotic. They say the Alaskan Inuit natives have over 50 different words for snow, because they experience it so often and in so many different forms. The Maltese have none. When he calls his sisters back on the island on a winter Sunday to trade family updates, he'll use the word silge, which means ice. So if this newly naturalized Mediterranean immigrant had anything in common with his wife from Scott County, Indiana, by way of El Paso, it was that neither of them was a child of snow country. Yet, like the South Benders they were to become, they quickly learned to shovel snow. They taught themselves how to shift and brake differently when driving on snow, and adopted the cultural norm of talking with enthusiasm about memorable snows, even ones before their time, in an ever-escalating cascade of superlatives. Thus, when we celebrate my birthday each passing year, their story of that night in January of 1982 seems to grow in meteorological ferocity, the temperature further and further below zero, and the snow cover ever higher above eye level, to the point that if you take them literally when they tell the story of the night I was born, it is an utter miracle that I made it out of the hospital, or indeed that anyone survived at all. But somehow, with help from Maria Concetta Portelli Buttigieg, my weather-shocked Maltese grandmother, who made her first and only trip to America for the occasion, along with my astonished young Aunt Miriam, Mom and Dad successfully delivered me to their small two-story house on College Street on the northwest side of South Bend. To be born in 1982 is to be just old enough to remember the Soviet Union, and to have its fall be the first seismic geopolitical event of your lifetime. I remember the kid who dominated second-grade show and tell with a little chunk of the Berlin Wall, gray and rough on one side, but smooth and painted on the other, a trophy from his father's business trip to Europe. And there was Miss Martin, repeatedly explaining to us why our maps and globes with Union of Soviet Socialist Republics spread in impossibly stretched letters across the Siberian tundra were now obsolete. Coming into the world in the early 1980s puts you in that senior segment of the millennial generation that still remembers life before the smartphone. Today, I couldn't tell you the number of the phone on my own desk, but I still know my friend Joe's number from sixth grade, because I would punch it daily after school on a phone we had not yet learned to call a landline. If I dial that number, even today, one of his parents will still pick up. I'm young enough that I don't always use a TV set to watch television, but old enough that you might catch me using the phrase flat-screen TV, as if they sell any other kind. Only now can I make sense of the way my grandparents' generation used to talk of color TV, long past the time when you could find a black-and-white TV for sale anywhere in America. From my freshman dorm room in late 2000, the most high-tech thing I did every morning was log on to South Bend's WNDU.com and look at the 2-inch square, low-resolution still image from the webcam on their transmission tower, aimed at the Golden Dome, updated every few minutes. A grainy but comforting link to home. Websites didn't have much to them back then, I can see myself telling my grandchildren one day. But things moved quickly. By senior year, as I was banging out my thesis on an early model iBook, a few sophomores in another dorm were creating a website patterned after the Facebooks that Harvard passed out at the beginning of the year so that we could figure out who was who in the dining hall. Being in your 30s today means you have lived more or less half and half with Democratic and Republican presidencies, known 20 years of peace and 15 of war. It means you were grazing the boundaries of adulthood, when we all experienced the sudden reversal of what some fashionable scholars had taken to calling the end of history after the close of the Cold War. That shock came my sophomore year, a crisp September day in Boston, as it was in Manhattan, when history thundered back into being. It wasn't hard to tell by sundown that everything would be different, that irony and apathy wouldn't dominate our years after all, that our generation would go to war, just as our parents and their parents did. History was back, and in hindsight, it's obvious that we had actually never been living outside its rhythm. But in the horror of that sunny Tuesday, all we could make out was the onset of a major shift. I remember thinking that suddenly our generation's project had been abruptly reassigned, that yesterday we had been absorbed in Clinton-era concerns around globalization, the distribution of wealth, and the consequences of technology, but now we were being plunged into a different realm, dominated by things like warfare and terrorism. Today, it's come full circle. We see how often war and terrorism are driven by the dynamics of globalization, the distribution of wealth, and the consequences of technology. Like laws of physics, these forces were animating our affairs all along, which should have been no surprise to people from a place like South Bend, a city wrestling with such forces long before economists and newspapers gave us terms like globalization and Rust Belt. By the time my parents' U-Haul appeared on College Street in May of 1980, little remained of South Bend's industrial heyday but a widespread plague of empty factory buildings. I grew up among them, unable to fathom the tragedy encoded in their condition. From the back seat of the car on the way to Martin's, I scarcely even asked about the enormous brick structure with the even taller white smokestack that we would pass after the turn onto Elwood Avenue. Ghostly, it presided over the junction where our residential area met the strip mall containing our go-to grocery store, along with Osco Drug, a Little Caesars, and a laundromat. Only years later would I go around the back of that giant brick brewery to explore the parking lot, bounded by an ex-railroad with waist-high weeds poking up between the ties, and look up at the several stories of ruin, with one outer wall gone completely, exposing floors in naked cross-section, like you'd see in footage of war zones, topped by inexplicable trees growing from somewhere on the fifth floor. Why do I not recall talking to classmates about the acres of collapsing Studebaker factories we would pass on the way to school along Michigan Street? If I'd grown up somewhere else and arrived to see this, I would have noticed little else. I don't think it was taboo to speak of it. It was just unremarkable, since we'd grown up in its midst. We were used to it. It was part of the furniture. Yet somehow none of this made it feel like a bad place for a child to grow up. The collapsing structures had their place in the larger texture of our neighborhoods, which also included well-kept parks and decent houses, with lawns and hedges and flowers. We didn't think of the empty factories as the scenery of a post-industrial bust town in the 1980s. We didn't think of them at all. They were just there, a visual set, accompanied by the soundtrack of life in South Bend. Crickets in the summer, crows in the fall, and all year long the echoing horns of trains rumbling through in the night on their way to Chicagoland. And if there was ruin in some corners of the city, there was majesty in others. There was the gleaming golden dome of the University of Notre Dame, the library with the mosaic mural of Touchdown Jesus overlooking the stadium, and the stadium itself, the house that Newt Rockne built, which I vaguely understood to be a historic and hallowed place, even before I understood what football was and what it meant around here. Its orange bricks, colored a little differently than most of the rest of campus, signaled something important. Fidgeting with my seatbelt on days when Mom or Dad brought me along to campus, I could turn and gaze up at the mysterious structure, try to fathom the bizarre geometry of the underside of the concrete risers. Dad, why is there an upside-down stairway? And sense that this place, neither civic nor religious, was somehow both. Growing up in any place with a lost golden age, you absorb its legacy in fragments, hearing once great names, Oliver, Morris, Bendix, Studebaker, without being able to match them to anything living. You take them in, at first without comprehension, like the names of saints. Only as you grow older, with more education and context, you begin to picture how such giants of industry must have thrown their weight around their city, and what it might have been like as our factory precincts heaved with tens of thousands of workers at a time. A century ago, city boosters burst with pride as they celebrated and marketed South Bend. A 1901 book published by the South Bend Tribune begins, "South Bend, no inland city on the American continent, has attained greater renown or displayed more fully those sterling virtues of modern manhood and human progress than this beautiful city located on the banks of the magnificent and picturesque St. Joseph River." A bit more factually, a 1919 Pictorial Souvenir of South Bend made a series of impressive assertions. It is, of course, generally known that Studebaker's plant is the largest vehicle factory in the world, and that the Oliver Plow Company is the largest plow factory in the world. But it is not generally realized how many more of the city's establishments are among the largest of their kind. It goes on to document the fact that the Folding Paper Box Company had the largest paper box factory in Indiana, and one of the largest in the world, and that the Birdsall Manufacturing Company housed the largest makers of clover hullers in the world. South Bend companies made brooms, cigars, spark arresters, whatever that is, gears, gloves, white ice cream, mattresses, plows, stoves, rubber, shirts, tents, dowels, bicycles, and fishing tackle, among countless other products. And, famously, there were the pocket watches. The South Bend Watch Company made products so precise that at trade shows they would freeze a watch in a big block of ice, where you could see it, still ticking faithfully inside. An old advertisement has an image of the watch in the ice, but for me the most remarkable thing in the ad is something else that strikes you as you read its big letters. South Bend Watch. Frozen in ice keeps perfect time. South Bend Watch Company, South Bend, Indiana. How powerful the very name of our city must have been. All you had to do to sell watches, besides put one in a block of ice, was name them after our city. That was enough by way of branding. The name South Bend was a byword for workmanship and precision. I'm proud to own a couple, one of them a 1909 model, which still keeps pretty good time if you wind it up. The company made over 1 million watches, but failed to realize how much was at stake when rivals began marketing the trench watch, a World War I innovation that put watches on leather straps on men's wrists. The company lumbered along as though nothing had changed, producing some of the best-known pocket watches of the early wristwatch age. Their failure to innovate was fatal. The firm did not survive the crash of 1929. The easy lesson to draw from this is that you must innovate to survive. But you could find a more nuanced moral of the story, that keeping up doesn't always mean making something completely new. To survive, South Bend Watch wouldn't have needed to start making radios or computers. They just needed to adapt a good thing they already had and refine their business. If they and Studebaker and some other companies had managed to do this, I might have grown up in a different South Bend. Down Michigan Street, just south of the Studebaker factory district, sits the United Auto Workers Local 5 Hall, home to what was once America's largest auto union local. Like many auto workers' halls, it has a stage for speaking, with an American flag, a portrait of Walter Reuther on the wall, and a big UAW logo painted as a backdrop, matching the smaller one affixed to the podium. But unlike any other local union hall I've seen, its concrete block walls on either side are covered with murals depicting the union's story, including Studebaker's fall, as seen from the perspective of the workers. One section shows workers making an uncertain departure from the factory grounds on the day that their jobs, and thousands of others, came to a sudden end. Old-timers on the west side can tell you what it was like on that gray December day in 1963, just weeks after the Kennedy assassination, when news got out that the company was about to shut down. Jack Colwell, who covers me to this day in his South Bend Tribune columns, was the bearer of doom in a story he broke as a Cub reporter under the headline, "Auto Output to End Here." Jack, who also teaches at Notre Dame and writes a weekly column on politics, is gentle and disarming, never breaking his smile as he toggles his gaze, now looking down at his notepad full of orderly script, now back up at you through his glasses as he listens intently. Like Mark Peterson, another experienced local reporter, he has a way of looking at you as if you were about to say something very interesting and important, which of course makes you want to oblige rather than stick to your talking points. Maybe that's how Jack got the scoop, a day before Studebaker planned to make the announcement from a safe remove in New York City. It was probably the biggest local story ever, but South Bend was not ready to hear it. Jack wrote later that some workers, quote, were hostile toward carriers delivering that paper, that news, at shift end to gate one on Sample Street, end quote, with one repeatedly yelling, "It's not official yet." Social science research hadn't yet confirmed that sudden job loss can be the psychological equivalent of losing a loved one, but everyone must have sensed the depth of harm this news would bring, as thousands of jobs were wiped out in a matter of days. Some were defiant about the city's future, like Paul Gilbert, the clothing store owner, who told a gathering of civic leaders, "This is not Studebaker, Indiana. This is South Bend, Indiana." But there was no escaping the fact that we had become a company town without its company. The decline was not instantaneous, but 1963 was like a fulcrum. There was before, and there was after. It is difficult for someone born 20 years later to truly picture before, but you can see it in the bustle of our downtown on the old postcards. You can sense it in the grandeur of the big stone houses, castles almost, that the local titans of industry built to live in. In old photos, you can sense that the South Bend Tribune was justified in describing the Oliver Hotel as, quote, "the best and most magnificent in Indiana," end quote, when it opened in 1899, complete with frescoes in the lobby and steam baths downstairs. Nor were South Bend's charms just for the wealthy. Bob Urbanski was the son of a butcher in a big Polish family, like so many others on the West Side. He was clearly bright, yet he had been struggling to follow lessons in class, and his seventh-grade teacher realized it had something to do with his eyesight. "He moved me to the front of the class and asked some questions and met my father one day after school and talked to him," Bob remembered. It turned out Bob needed glasses. So his father took him to the eye doctor downtown, where he was examined and got his first prescription. He remembers emerging and seeing the splendor of the downtown for the first time. "And I walked outside, and I looked to the north down Michigan Street, and I was just awed. The lights weren't just a blur. It was like someone took a camera lens, and they were crisp. You could see the sign for Osco's and Spiro's and Milady Shop and Robertson's and Wyman's Department Store, all the stuff that was down there." What young Bob saw was a dense cluster of clothing, furniture, and department stores that transacted the arrival of the modern American middle class. The avenue was packed, and on Mondays and Thursdays, the shops would stay open into evening. As in the department store scene of A Christmas Story, it was a special occasion for kids to accompany their parents downtown to shop, typically before Easter, or a new suit for a communion, that sort of thing. Then they would return home to a West Side bustling with families, moving among neighborhood groceries, churches, and taverns, as the aroma of half a dozen Eastern European countries' cuisines wafted into the city air. At Christmas, fish head soup would be served, and, of course, there would be pierogies. Bob's grandma would make 100 of them at a time, rolling the dough on a table, putting the cheese on them, folding them by hand. The kids would eat them right out of the boiling pot. But my grandpa would take it, slit the thing, put butter in each one, then pour cream over it. That was reserved for special occasions, but when bread could be truly fresh, it could be a treat any day. So much that some days, Bob's father literally couldn't wait to get the bread home from the Hungarian bakery. He would bring a quarter stick of butter from home with him when he went to pick up the boys from school downtown. If they saw the butter in the front seat, they knew they were going to the bakery, just in time for the hot bread to come out of the oven at 3 o'clock. We'd go over there and get a loaf of it, and it wasn't sliced. We'd get to the car and tear it, and he had his pocket knife and he'd chop up butter and put it on if you wanted it. The day he died, Bob's father was making a pot of czernina, a Polish duck blood soup, stirring in the potato dumplings. Children were raised not just by parents, but by neighborhoods. Gladys Muhammad, about the same age as Bob, remembers the LaSalle Park neighborhood. You could go anywhere, next door anywhere, and eat. They just invite you in and eat, and if you'd done anything wrong, the neighbors would tell on you, so everybody was real disciplined. Gladys went to Washington High School, which was racially integrated, but the neighborhoods were not. Redlining hemmed in African Americans like her to the LaSalle Park area, colloquially known as the Lake, after the pond at the bottom of the sledding hill there. Walking to school, Gladys would have to cross the railroad tracks, sometimes clambering through an open boxcar to get there. African-American residents couldn't live south of the tracks, though they were more than welcome to work, as her father did, alongside the Polish and Hungarian and Irish men on the line at Studebaker. Certain days of the week you can still get pierogies, cabbage or cheese-filled, at Joe's Tavern on the near west side, one of those neighborhood watering holes nestled between houses to one side and an industrial site across the street. But on your way there, you will pass by the hulking mass of the biggest factories we haven't torn down yet. Deeper into the neighborhood, you will see the vacant lots where cozy homes used to host the family gatherings that Bob and Gladys remember from their childhoods. You will sense the slow decline that followed that pivotal December day. It's our version of a story that played out, in some fashion, across the American Midwest. We've lost over 30,000 people since the 1960s, the population falling to about 100,000, while our per capita personal income sank by 2010 to $18,805, half the national average. In parallel with the general outmigration from the region, to Chicago or beyond, a local realignment gradually emptied the urban core. By the time I was born, shops and residents had started to flow from the heart of the city. You no longer went to get your first communion suit from Gilbert's or Robertson's downtown anymore. You went instead to the JCPenney at the mall in nearby Mishawaka. You no longer headed for the Hungarian bakery. You went to a new location that Martin's had strategically positioned on the road that leads out of downtown toward the mall and the new subdivisions. Swiftly and inexorably, the cornfields and wetlands that ringed the outer limits of our metro area were marked for development and transformed into suburban plazas of chain stores and office parks, great angular islands in a sea of parking lots. Even my elementary school, square and carpeted wall to wall, was located in an office park. By the time I sat in its airy second-grade classroom in 1990, the big family name in town had nothing to do with manufacturing. Now it was real estate, and the Cressy family had become prominent after Don Cressy put a big shopping mall northeast of town, on the other side of Notre Dame and outside the South Bend city limits. University Park Mall was not that close to the university, nor was there a park nearby, but by the time I was growing up, it had become the epicenter of our social and commercial life. Its popularity led to more retail and residential subdivisions around it, a big-box frontier of development pressing northward one cornfield at a time, almost all the way to Michigan. I liked our house in the city, but envied the high ceilings, generous rec rooms, and huge sloping lawns of the well-off people I knew from school who populated these newer subdivisions. We were doing fine, but to a professor's kid, the doctors and lawyers seemed extravagantly wealthy. Most of them lived in Granger, a sprawling and unincorporated zone of spacious houses on winding streets with names like Clarendon Hills Drive and Hunting Ridge Trail that signaled affluence and a certain upper-middle-class taste. The most abundant animal species there is surely the Canadian goose, but you wouldn't know it from the street names. Within a square mile or two, you can find Fox Point Lane, Fox Cross Drive, Foxdale Lane, Fox Chase Court, Red Fox Drive, Fox Trail, and so on right on up to the state line. South Bend proper was a different domain, filled with older East European Westsiders who kept pristine lawns in front of their small ranch houses. Black families, unless they could afford the leap to Granger, mostly clustered in the near northwest and far west side, and the public servant class of cops and schoolteachers, who would tend to avoid a neighborhood that didn't have sidewalks. And there was the occasional professor, who eschewed suburban life for the charm of a historic house, or couldn't afford otherwise on a junior faculty salary, or just hadn't come under the sway of the realtors then nudging people out to the suburbs as they scoped out options while moving in from around Dartmouth or Palo Alto. That's how my parents found the house on College Street that my mother spotted and swiftly purchased on a quick scouting trip from El Paso. As a child, I had no idea that Westside would come to be considered dangerous by the denizens of Granger and some in the city, too. Later, we moved to a brick house on Marquette Avenue, down the hill from St. Joseph High, and therefore a convenient place for me to have friends over after school. It came back to me later that some parents hesitated to let their children come to our house, because it was in the city. If there was a racial layer to that phrase, I was too young to catch it. In fact, it was a perfectly safe neighborhood, full of kids and dogs, with families who went back for decades, keeping an eye out for each other. The houses were close together, about 32 a block, under a leafy layer of treetops that shaded us in the summer, painted the neighborhood in fall, and left creaking branches for the wind to howl through in wintertime. When it was too cold to do much outside, I passed after-school afternoons in a finished room in the basement with my friends, growing pudgy on store-brand cola and popcorn as we took in Star Trek reruns or Bulls games, or bled off excess energy wrestling until a parent would come down to see what the ruckus was. Our neighborhood was called, a bit grandly, the North Shore Triangle, because it is bordered by the fast-flowing run of the St. Joseph River as it runs northwest at an angle, with the curving Angela Boulevard on the north and the busier four-lane Michigan Street to the east. As the land inches down toward the river, the property values slope upward, forming a tidy triangular slice of the middle class about six blocks across. In the middle of that triangle is Nokomis Park, better known as Triangle Park, the general headquarters of my boyhood. The park didn't have or need any playground equipment or water features, just trees, a metal trash barrel, and an irregularly placed streetlight in the middle. Its simplicity made it perfect for me and my friends, Joe and Ben, an adaptable field suitable for baseball, football, and battle. If it felt like time for an adventure, we could cross Angela and venture along the old coal line toward St. Mary's College, veering off into the woods that led to a bluff over the river. You could get close to the water if you carefully maneuvered down the slope, but if you weren't careful, a patch of clay would take your leg all the way up to the knee. You could get your leg back with help from friends pulling mightily, but your shoe would be gone forever. It's still a good neighborhood, but it's rare for a house to be worth what it cost to build. Today, the most expensive houses in the neighborhood, big ones on the river, can run as much as $300,000. The cheapest, one-story houses with vinyl siding and attached garages, can be had for around $60,000. Chasten and I now live on the same block as Mom and Dad, and the mortgage payment on our large old house facing the river comes to about $450. About 2 miles up the hill gleams the gold leaf of the Golden Dome. Those who have never visited may know little else about us than that we host the university, along with St. Mary's and Holy Cross College across the street. Yet Notre Dame rose to real prominence only after our industrial fame had collapsed, and campus and community lived mostly separate lives for most of our history. Still, if South Bend was never exactly a college town, we have long been a football town. I can still remember the first time, not yet five, when I witnessed tailgate country. Most of the accoutrements of tailgating are useless to a small child, which is probably why I have no memory of beer cans or chicken wings. But I do clearly recall a cake in the shape of a football, a cacophony of radios and gadgets playing the Notre Dame fight song, and everyone dressed in blue, gold, and green. Tailgating made no sense to me then, but I understood what a party was, and this looked like the biggest birthday party I had ever seen. Bundled up in my winter coat and accompanying my parents on a game day walk around campus, I asked them what the big party was for. Matter-of-factly and in unison, they answered, "The game." When I turned 6, I was deemed old enough to start going with Dad, who until then had brought our next-door neighbor, Leon Helak, a police officer, to sit with him in his seats in the southwest corner, Section 21, Row 42, which his faculty status gave him the privilege of buying each year. I don't know when this literary scholar picked up his taste for American football, but it must go back in some way to his boyhood devotion to the great English soccer club, Manchester United. After all, that loyalty meant he was totally at home as part of a roaring mass in the stands of a great stadium, cheering for a team known by its deep and legendary tradition. When the Man United team plane crashed on takeoff in 1958 in Munich, the disaster at once claimed the lives of my father's soccer heroes and cemented his lifelong loyalty to the team, as much as a 1931 crash in Kansas both took Notre Dame coach Newt Rockne's life and sealed his legendary status. Perhaps that's why my father's fondness for Notre Dame football showed no sign of the gap in affinity that you might expect to see between the Fighting Irish and a non-religious Mediterranean intellectual. One afternoon, 30 years after the Munich tragedy, he cheerfully guided his bewildered son up to his place on the weathered wooden bench to take in his first game, against Purdue. It wasn't even close. Lou Holtz was coaching. You could make out his red hair, even from our corner seats two-thirds of the way up. The quarterback, Tony Rice, ran 38 yards for a touchdown, and later threw a 54-yard touchdown pass to the soon-to-be legendary Raghib Rocket Ismail. The crowd roared when Ricky Waters returned a punt 60 yards to the end zone, imprinting on my young brain the idea that every kickoff must be a scoring opportunity. Clutching the program my father had bought me, a $4 extravagance so that we could check the players by number, I stood on my seat to see the field when the fans leapt up for a big play. I was watching what would become the national championship team of 1988. Over the years, the mysteries of the stadium began to decode themselves. I finally grasped that those strange concrete forms that had looked like upside-down stairways leading nowhere were in fact the underside of the stands. I began to understand the difference between the regulars, who kept the same seats for decades, as my father would, and the ones who came in one game at a time after buying tickets from one of the scalpers standing out by the toll road exit. I learned about penalties, rushes, passes, touchbacks, and safeties. And amid the magnificent swearing of people sitting around us, I started to gather how profanity may be abusive, but also poetic. I learned about hierarchy, too. There were alumni, a word I came to associate with combed-over gray hair, blue blazers, blue and gold striped ties, beige raincoats, and the smell of cigars. The nearer to the 50-yard line and the closer to the field I looked, the more gray hair and beige coats. Our seats were more the domain of the fans, sporting Notre Dame jackets and scarves and hats and socks. And of course there were students, a mysterious kind of proto-adult whose ranks dominated the northwest corner of the stadium and who stood for the whole game. Then there were the ushers, the same men each year, who conveyed in their yellow jackets and white caps such authority that it is peculiar to think that they were volunteers with day jobs rather than full-time members of a football-oriented military order. Indeed, there actually was a football-oriented militaristic order, the elite and selective Irish Guard, consisting of tall, kilt-clad students in narrow bearskin hats who marched out magnificently behind the band's drum majors and performed the flag honors at the beginning of each game. Some things I did not understand, and wouldn't for years. At 6, I could detect but not fathom the controversy when the students arrived at the vaunted 1988 Miami game wearing t-shirts that read, "Catholics versus Convicts." Nor could I then figure out what motivated my father's wrath when he turned to some fans in the next row, aggravated by their catcalling Tony Rice, our second-ever black quarterback, over his grade point average, and said to one of them, "I'd like to see your grade point average." I could not have then comprehended the tension involved in the fact that my father was a man of the left, no easy thing on a campus like Notre Dame's in the 1980s. I would learn later that many of his closest friendships among the faculty were sealed amid the protests of his early years, such as the time he spoke out against the Reagan administration's covert support for human rights abusers in Latin America during the popular president's visit to campus. All I knew at the time was that he took me to the airport to see Air Force One through a chain-link fence at the end of the runway. As reliably as most students were conservative, the humanities faculty members were overwhelmingly liberal. From dinner tables at the homes of my parents' professor friends, I would hear words and names that would mean nothing to me then, but in retrospect make it very clear what was on their minds. Reaganite, intellectual, Iran-Contra, Lynn Cheney. Half the table talk was just faculty gossip, and that was pretty understandable to me by the age of 10 or so because it wasn't that different from the talk at school. But the other part, the reference-laden intellectual and political discussion, was opaque. I would hear but not understand arguments over the uselessness of post-structuralism or the relevance of Hobsbawm's historiography, wondering what any of it meant and how anyone could be as passionate about it as the people seated at the dinner table who just a couple hours earlier were indulgingly asking me about my loose tooth or my baseball card collection. At first I tuned it out, awaiting the first opportunity to excuse myself from the table with the other kids and go watch TV, especially if the house we were visiting had cable, or play tag. Like the coffee they would pour to go with dessert, their style of conversation was an acquired taste. But the more I heard these aging professors talk, the more I wanted to learn how to decrypt their sentences and to grasp the political backstory of the grave concerns that commanded their attention and aroused such fist-pounding dinner debate. When I was 14, Mom and Dad sent me to St. Joseph High School, the Catholic school up the hill from our place housed in a 1950s-era tan brick building, sometimes confused for a light industrial structure, due to the surprisingly high smokestack of its old incinerator. This offered its own sort of political education. At St. Joe, we were brought up not only to learn church doctrine on matters like sexuality and abortion, but also to understand the history of the church as a voice for the oppressed and downtrodden. At all-school mass in the bleachers of the airy, aging gym, we would pray for the various places and peoples around the world experiencing oppression. My adjustment to high school life first unfolded under the command of Father Bly, who presided from an elevated desk with a dog-eared Bible on it, as he had since the 1960s, teaching the Old Testament. He had reluctantly consented to the mixing of girls and boys a few years earlier, but had succeeded in refusing to allow his room to be renovated, so we sat in those 50s-style seats, with the desk built into them, bolted onto the floor. With a sort of terrified reverence, we held still as Father Bly expounded on the wisdom of the ages, beginning with Genesis. As he lectured, he rarely budged from the stool behind his raised desk. Rumor had it that with an imperceptible movement, he could send that Bible flying into the forehead of any student caught sleeping. Occasionally, he would lighten things up by passing out copies from what must have been a mountainous library of National Geographic back issues, so we could look at pictures of the Holy Land or something else he considered interesting. Once, he distributed an issue that contained satellite photos of subdivisions and golf courses being built in the deserts of Arizona, made possible by irrigation schemes that diverted water from the Colorado River. You could see the giant green squares in the satellite imagery, surrounded by barren sand and mountains. There are whole towns in Mexico, he explained, where the riverbed now runs dry because the water is drained upstream in the American Southwest. Next came the moral of the story. This weekend, you will probably go to the University Park Mall, and you may run into some atheists, he pronounced, lingering on the consonants at the end of the word, hissing a little, atheists, without losing his aloof posture and 100-yard stare. These atheists will tell you, there is no God, there is no heaven, and there is no hell. And how will you answer them? You will tell them, of course there is a God, and a heaven, and a hell. There must be a hell, because where else would you put the man who built this golf course? In government class, we were shown the 1989 film Romero, in which Raul Julia plays the Salvadoran bishop assassinated in 1980 by right-wing paramilitary after challenging the ruling elites in El Salvador. Shocked that this could have happened within living memory, with what looked like American complicity, I began paying more attention to human rights. The school had a small chapter of Amnesty International, which raised a few $100s every year and conducted letter-writing campaigns. I joined and eventually became president of the 6-or-so-strong group. Here came an early lesson in the realities of organizing. It was nearly impossible to get people to volunteer to help write letters to political prisoners at the little card table I put up outside the lunch hall. But we got hundreds to come to the Battle of the Bands, organized to raise money for the club. On balance, the school faculty was far from a liberal bunch. A monument to aborted fetuses on school grounds reminded us all that pro-life politics was an article of faith, and many teachers were skeptical of the perceived bleeding-heart tendencies of their more social justice-oriented colleagues. Mr. Dubois, who taught gym and drafting, comes to mind. He spoke with a thick southern Indiana drawl, combed what remained of his white hair back, and usually called gym class to order by barking, "Line up, you idiots!" Or occasionally, for variety, "Line up, you morons!" Over time, I would come to understand that this was a way of showing affection, but you can see how, at least early on, this could be a little intimidating, especially since gym class was not my scene. It would be a good 10 years or so before I experienced any real level of physical fitness, so the primary objective was to survive without embarrassment. I could handle myself in touch football just by throwing my weight around, because half my classmates had not yet caught up to my then-imposing 5'8". But basketball was more nuanced and less forgiving. Once, after I somehow made a basket, Mr. Dubois pulled me aside at dismissal and offered something that might be described as encouragement. "But, man," he began, "I see a lot of potential in you. Keep working at it." But some weeks later, he stopped to talk to me with something else on his mind. He'd heard I was getting mixed up in Amnesty International, Mr. Dubois was not fond of what he called Arabs, so I could see where this was going. I stiffened and told him that I was running our chapter now, and that I felt that was consistent with the values we were being taught in theology class. There must have been a little more force in my voice than either of us had expected, because he responded with a respectful nod, followed by a cheerful snort. Well, to each his own, I guess. He smiled and returned his gaze to his clipboard as he proceeded toward a new victim on the gym floor, a sophomore whom he had decided for some reason to nickname Recruit. By high school, I had traded my oversized, thick glasses for contact lenses, but my eyesight was getting worse every year, smothering my childhood aspiration of becoming an astronaut or at least a pilot. But in the meantime, I had begun to wonder what it would be like to be involved in public service directly, instead of reading or watching movies about it. Could political action be a calling, not just the stuff of dinner table talk? I got on to every mailing list I could, and from every political persuasion, from the local Republican Party to the Democratic Socialists of America. I wanted to find out how people went about being involved in ways more impactful than lonely letter-writing campaigns. And I decided to try my hand at leadership in student government, first losing an election for student body treasurer, but then winning one for senior class president. In an assembly in the dining hall, the five or so candidates for class president gave our short speeches, using a closed-top trash can as a kind of makeshift podium, and once the scraps of paper got counted up, I had won my first election. I kept up top grades, and by senior year, a flow of mailed college recruiting brochures accumulated into an avalanche on our dining room table. Sifting through them, I tried to picture a future as a college student. There was something distant and even intimidating about the imagery. Confident, smiling, diverse students in sweatshirts, chatting and laughing in small groups on tidy quadrangles, or walking cheerily with their backpacks through autumn foliage on slightly different variations of the universal college campus. It was hard to picture myself at ease like these students. I wasn't even at ease in the halls of my own high school, even as a class president. But the letters and brochures made it seem like the colleges were happy to have me. I applied to about 10 of them, hoping above all for a shot at Harvard. The odds seemed long. I'd even heard of valedictorians from St. Joe being turned away. But I had to make the attempt. When I got home one day and saw a letter from Harvard on the mail table, I didn't get my hopes up too much. It was not a thick envelope. I feigned nonchalance, setting my backpack down before heading back to pick up the letter that might hold a key to my future, while my parents kept a discreet but unconvincing distance in the living room. I usually open letters with my finger, but this one deserved a letter opener. Pulling out the page of watermarked paper, I read the opening line over and over again. I am delighted to inform you. Slowly, I allowed myself to believe the letter from this dean of admissions, and by the time I studied the bottom with a little, "Hope you will join us," written in ballpoint pen near the signature, it felt like the establishment had thrown its doors open and beckoned me inside. All I had to do was leave South Bend. I had never been to Boston, but I wound up going twice during that last semester of high school. The first was a planned college visit after I got admitted, sleeping on the floor of a freshman dorm and learning what to expect from the campus, at least physically. The second was an all-expense-paid trip that came as even more of a surprise than the admission to Harvard. At the urging of my teachers, I had submitted an entry to an essay contest sponsored by the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library as part of their annual Profile in Courage Award. Around South Bend, President Kennedy was on par with Lincoln. As the first Catholic president, he had won the undying loyalty of the white ethnic working class, and as the man who had invited America to shoot for the moon, he was the first example of presidential leadership that I had understood as a child. Participating in the contest seemed almost like a duty. I worked for days on an essay about Carolyn McCarthy, who had run for Congress on gun policy issues after her husband was shot and killed on the Long Island Railroad. I had nearly finished the essay when I went online to research a couple last details and found out that the previous year's winner had written about the same person. I would have to start from scratch. Rushing to come up with an alternate plan, I decided to write about someone I had found even more interesting, if a little more edgy politically. An obscure Vermont congressman, Bernie Sanders, had been reelected for years as a socialist in a then generally Republican state. At a time when vagueness and opportunism in politics seemed to be the order of the day, here was an elected official who succeeded by being totally transparent and relentless about his values. Socialist was the dirtiest word in politics, yet he won because people saw that he came by his values honestly. Regardless of whether you agreed politically, it certainly seemed like a profound courage to me. Years later, when I was running for mayor, I would check my mailbox one morning and find a mass mailing from the local Republican Party, I guess I was still on the list, warning that Pete Buttigieg was dangerously leftist, citing the high school essay as proof. I wasn't too worried about it. By then, even many local Republicans were supporting me, but it prompted me to go back and find the essay. It definitely reads like something written by a high schooler, starting with the opening sentence, "In this new century, there are a daunting number of important issues which are to be confronted if we are to progress as a nation." Other comments fit the times then but no longer ring true, such as when I lamented that a strong conservative like Pat Buchanan has been driven off the ideological edge of an increasingly centrist Republican Party. But the basic premise still holds, that candidates for office can easily develop an ability to outgrow their convictions in order to win power, and that Sanders was an inspiring exception. Also impressive to me then was the fact that Sanders often worked across the aisle, collaborating with Republicans when possible, and using his position as the only independent in Congress to drive dialogue on issues like trade. The lesson here, which Sanders himself would demonstrate some 20 years later when he ran for president, was that bipartisanship and appeal to independents were not the same thing as ideological centrism. I wrote that Sanders' quote, "real impact has been as a reaction to the cynical climate which threatens the effectiveness of the democratic system." End quote. I had forgotten about the contest until one day in March, when one of my teachers appeared, beaming, in the hall, and pulled me aside after class. "I had won first prize," she said, "and would be flown to the library in Boston to meet the award committee and accept the scholarship money that went along with it." A few weeks later, wearing a newly purchased suit, my first, I stepped into the soaring atrium of the JFK Library in Boston Harbor. Beneath its giant American flag, flanked by my parents, our principal, Mr. Cassidy, and two teachers from St. Joe, I was ushered to an elevator and up to a reception room commanding views of the Boston skyline, with planes descending toward the airport and ships crossing the harbor. It was unlike anything in Indiana. My eyes widened as people I had only read about in the news milled about holding soft drinks. The lanky and cheerful Senator Al Simpson, Republican from Wyoming, widely known as one of the wittiest members of Congress, began talking to me as if we'd known each other for years. I was too new around politics to realize that for him, this was a professional skill as well as a personal quality. "You have to keep a sense of humor, otherwise they'll chew your ass and it'll get you down," he advised. A distinguished-looking journalist named John Siegenthaler casually mentioned that he had launched USA Today, while another elderly patrician gentleman dropped that he had once chaired the Democratic National Committee. Dignified and quiet, Caroline Kennedy was standing a little apart from the other guests with her three children at her side, looking as much like an attentive mother as like the American political royalty she was. Then I had my first experience of the feeling in a room when a very famous person walks in. The energy of the room shifted perceptibly, and I turned to see the arrival of Senator Ted Kennedy, the Lion of the Senate. Moving slowly but with a kind of fire in his crisp blue eyes that made him all at the same time seem fierce and warm, he was heralded by the kids yelling, "Uncle Teddy," as they rushed from Caroline's side into his enormous embrace. Feeling at once elevated and humbled, I was suddenly aware of looking like an Indiana hayseed, a schoolboy shaking hands with an icon. I have no recollection of what either of us said until the end of the conversation, when he offered me an internship the following summer in his Washington office. His voice, full of Boston ahs, sounded just like that of President Kennedy, challenging America to go to the moon and do other great things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. In my mind, listening to the senator speak, I heard the strains of historic presidential leadership. It felt like I had been handed a ticket to the major leagues. Section 2. Learning. To learn, one must be humble, but life is the great teacher. James Joyce. Chapter 2. City on a Hill. On the underground platform at the stop for Harvard Square, the approaching Red Line train made itself felt as well as heard. A breeze of air would push out of the darkness of the curving tunnel a beat ahead of the rumble and light from the lead car. Each time I sensed that little gust during my freshman fall, it brought with it the thrill of knowing I now lived in a city. I know now that, by the standards of major global cities, Boston is mid-sized. Cambridge itself might